At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare, with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Medicine. I'm your host, Yonatan Krad. In this podcast, we pick a new book on a topic related to medicine, and we interview the author of that book. This time, as the inaugural podcast, I'm happy to say that we have Elizabeth Pisani on the show, and we'll be talking with her about her book, The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS. When in medical school, I found myself drawn to the study of infectious diseases in large part because of the mixture of science and anthropology. Infectious diseases are always about the way we interact with the world around us, what we do with whom and when and where and how often. Take the recent examples of the global spread of pandemic influenza, a respiratory virus spread through air droplets, and the epidemic of cholera in Haiti, which is spread because of a lack of access to clean water, and how in each case the spread of the infection says something about the world and the ways in which the world's population is connected. Now, the most important infection of our time is HIV, and its predominant modes of transmission are particularly complicated and culturally loaded human behaviors, sex and IV drug use. In her engaging, informative, and fun book, The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS, Elizabeth Pisani draws on her experience doing field work as an epidemiologist in Indonesia and on staff at UNAIDS, the joint United Nations program on HIV/AIDS, during the time when the world was coming to grips with the fact of an exploding global epidemic of HIV. If you want to design effective interventions, as these groups do, you have to understand exactly who and what those interventions should target. But how easy is it to figure out who has sex with whom and when and where and how often, or who injects drugs and shares needles? Doing so is loaded with pitfalls, and Elizabeth lays them out for us, exploring how preconceptions, ignorance, and technical problems can cloud our ability to see what's really happening, to interpret what we see, and most importantly, to figure out effective ways to intervene. She reminds us that what's true for Jersey may be completely false in Jakarta. And on top of that, how do you convince the people who hold the purse strings to pay for everything? These are the fascinating problems, and we thank Elizabeth for sharing her compelling insights.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Today, we are talking with Elizabeth Pisani about her book, The Wisdom of Horrors. I've read it, enjoyed it thoroughly, and recommend it very highly. I especially like the way the working of epidemiology is laid bare, and the critical eye the book brings to all aspects of the field, from how data is acquired through how it is presented and at times even manipulated. And I also really like the way the book discusses the investigations and explanations of HIV and AIDS, and how the programs and interventions work and don't work. It's a rollicking, smart, compelling book and an excellent read. So, Elizabeth, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, my history is mixed and hard to understand. Given my accent, you'll probably be slightly surprised to know that I occasionally confess to having been born in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Really?
Yes. And then I had the great good fortune to have very peripatetic parents. They met when my father was hitchhiking around the world and my mother was hitchhiking around Europe. So all of you out there, beware of an immigration queue. It could stick with you longer than you think. So I sort of inherited the travel bug, but also had the good fortune to grow up in many different countries in Europe. And then I managed to do my first degree as a result of a bet made in a drunken moment in a underground bar in New York City when I was far too young to be drinking in bars in New York City. And the bet was that I wouldn't go and study classical Chinese at Oxford.
Oh, my goodness.
And sadly, I lost the bet, and therefore I did have to go and study classical cheese at Oxford. And from there, I started traveling in Asia. And had really quite a jolly time, and became very interested in the way different societies are organized and the way different political structures work, and the way different cultures and politics interact. And I became a foreign correspondent, and was posted in all sorts of fun places. But I started off in Hong Kong, and then I was in India, Indonesia. I did a lot of work in China. And in that process, I got really interested in the interaction between population and politics, because that's three of the four most populous countries in the world right there. Mm-hmm. And they all have really different approaches to population. And so after many years of late nights and long poker games and reporting on revolutions and stock market collapses and cholera epidemics and the like, mm-hmm. I thought, well, maybe I'll go back and study that stuff a bit. And there I started my transition from Chinese-speaking foreign correspondent to epidemiologist, which I know isn't an obvious transition. But it was a fun one. And to be honest, it's not that different. I mean, a lot of people don't even know what epidemiology is. You know, they look at me and they're like, is that like something a bit gross to do with skin? Mm-hmm. Like, no, it's a study of disease. And they're like, well, so how did you go from, you know, reporting on stock markets and revolutions in Tiananmen Square to being a, quote, expert in diseases?
Yes.
And I guess my thinking is that actually the skill base is almost identical.
Uh-huh.
You're basically trying to find the right people, ask them the right questions, organize the information, analyze it sensibly, and then communicate it to someone who could do something about it. So I think actually epidemiology and good outbreak epidemiology resembles good investigative reporting quite a lot. So the transition isn't really as weird as people expect.
Yes, in your introduction, you talk about the divide among epidemiologists between those who think their job is just to do science and those who think they are supposed to impact policy. And that also has parallels with journalism. And so I was wondering also how your experiences as a journalist impacted your conception of your role as an epidemiologist.
That's a very interesting question. I would say that it's not so much, I mean, obviously, I don't think it's so much my experience of the one that impacted the other, but possibly the shared roots that both of them have. Mm-hmm. I became a journalist for the same reason that I became an epidemiologist, essentially, which is that I'm interested in politics, policy, and human existence. And I'm vaguely, I mean, not to be too grandiose about it, but I'm sort of interested in being able to contribute to those constellations being more functional for more people than perhaps they are at the moment. So I would say, I guess that makes me on the very engaged mm-hmm. side of the debate on both journalism and epidemiology. You know, frankly, public health is, you know, the money's shit. It's long hours. It's not at all glamorous. It's not something that people sitting next to you at a dinner party say, wow, really? Mm-hmm. God, you're in public health. Isn't that sexy? You know, it's not sexy. It's not well paid. It's not whatever. So you better do it because you give a damn.
Right.
And if you give a damn, then I think it is your duty not just to generate evidence, but to do everything you can to try and make sure that that evidence is taken into account in the decision-making process. Mm-hmm. So yes, I agree that there's a fine line between communicating research results and engaging people with research results and actually, you know, pimping your data. But I think that, you know, and I guess even further down that line, we would use the word lobbying. Mm-hmm. But I think that if you're going to be in this field, just to say, look, you know, I did my study and I published in the New England Journal and now I've done my job, is to misunderstand what job it is you've chosen to do.
And so that actually provides a nice lead into a question about your book. So how did you come to write The Wisdom of Horrors?
Well, I've been working in HIV epidemiology, mostly focusing on national surveillance systems, trying to improve our data systems, trying to improve our understanding of both the distribution of the HIV virus, but principally the distribution concentration of behaviors that spread it at a national level for many years. And that leads you into, you do that because you want that information, those data, to help you to plan better responses. Principally, my interest is in prevention and using those information to try and improve prevention programs, but also to figure out whether what you're doing is having any impact. And I've been doing that for a good long time, a good over 10 years. And essentially, I was saying the same thing over and over again, and many others were too. It's not like I was saying anything that was radically different from many of my colleagues, but what we were seeing as HIV became increasingly politicized and it became increasingly well-funded was that money was being spent worse and worse, and we were collecting better and better data, so you could say, tick, job done, you know, that box. I've really done the job of helping to improve surveillance systems and whatever, you know, I've made a contribution in that field. But what wasn't changing nearly as much was what we were doing with that better information. So great to have better information, but not quite so great to go on ignoring it. And, you know, I've been banging the drum of what we should be doing with our data inside the field of HIV, inside what I call the AIDS mafia, for some time without all that much small changes, but not enough. And so I just thought, well, maybe sometimes maybe you have to throw your toys out of the cot a bit more publicly. Maybe we really need to try and help the people who are actually paying for all of this, which is you, the taxpayer, to understand how much more, how much better we could be doing with their money than we are.
Could you describe what you mean by the AIDS mafia?
You know, HIV is an industry like any other industry that develops its institutions and its institutional interests. People build careers around it. I'm one of them. You develop a whole, in this case, really quite large group of people and organizations and that rely for their very existence on money that's available for HIV programming. And so you get into a sort of circular, and this is, there's nothing special about HIV. This is true, I think, of every field, commercial or public sector. People get into a field because they care, but then, well, to do what I need to do, we need money, and therefore we need to lobby, and that puts us in a trench position, and now another institution that really actually is not interested in sex or drugs, which is what HIV is about, thinks, oh, look, HIV, lots of money in that. How do we get some of it? What do? Well, we do kids. Okay, so now it's about HIV and kids. Or what do? We do farming. Now it's about HIV and farming, etc. And more institutional interests arise. And it's very difficult if you're a person or an institution that is part of that structure that I call the AIDS mafia, to say, hey, wait a minute, actually, there's really, in the countries in which I work, there's no relationship between farming and HIV. Let's just butt out and let someone else have the money.
So that also leads to a question about how you got into this in the first place. So maybe could you talk a little bit about how you came to work for UNAIDS?
Yeah, not much to say, really. By the time I did that, I had a master's degree in medical demography, of all things, which is basically birth, death, and sex. And of those two things, I'm not a breeder, and I'm not that interested in birth. And death isn't a fun subject for anyone, but sex, that you can always raise an interest in, at least in me. And so I sort of started working within that field, taking an interest in studies of sexual behavior and fertility, motivations, and etc. And that was just at the time that UNAIDS was being formed, and they were starting to review, okay, what's really known about different patterns of sexual behavior around the world. And so I started, but I got put in touch with people who were looking for some sort of syntheses of what was known. And so I put together some reports for them, and they're like, oh, right, you can write intelligently. It seemed to be the only skill they cared about. Could you help us do our first annual report? And you think, yeah, not only can I write intelligently, but I can actually read data and you know, have a fairly good idea of where it's coming from, what the quality is. So I started in that way. And then when you start doing that, you look at the data and you think, oh my God, is this the best we have? Is this really what we're making decisions on at a global level? Is this really how we're deciding how to spend money or even how much money we need or et cetera? The data were really, really crap. And so then I got interested in helping to work on, you know, ways of improving data systems.
So maybe
it was also UNAIDS at the time. You know, UNAIDS is a weird beast because so it sort of the international institutions, their response to HIV was first of all in the World Health Organization, the Global Program on AIDS, I think probably very appropriately. But there were all kinds of political machinations going on there. The program was headed by the newly sainted Jonathan Mann. And he made a point that actually this wasn't just about HIV, was not just about health and not just about you know, disease and sickness and cures and prevention. It was also that had a whole social dimension that went with the stigma of that is attaches to the behaviors that spread it and et cetera, et cetera. And so there was this whole human rights agenda that crept in for extremely legitimate reasons. But once they started to formulate the issue of HIV in those really quite broad terms, and other agencies came along and said, well, wait a minute, if it's about human rights, it's us that do human rights. And, you know, the UNDP would say, well, if it's about development, we do development, you know, and then they're saying it's not just about gay men, it's also about women. And then, you know, UNICEF says, oh, well, if it's about women and kids, we do that. And so everyone wanted to sort of have a part of the pie to an extent. And the Global Program on AIDS was dissolved, and this new body, UNAIDS, not a UN agency in its own right, but a kind of secretariat, theoretically, that was just bringing together the HIV interests of all these different parties, was formed. And it's a bit like, you know, there's one big bully in the class who has all the toys. You take the toys away from him, you give, you know, a little bit of toy to seven other kids and say, now go play together nicely in the sandpit. You know, the bully still has the upper hand, and is not pleased about the toys being taken away. Everyone else is kind of jealous that you know, Susie got a bigger toy than Jack did, etc. And it's really not a happy sandpit. So I think the way that UNAIDS was conceived from the start was deeply problematic.
Right.
However, I will say that it was also at the start full of really fun, really smart, really dedicated people who were not UN functionaries, who were not yet part of the mafia, and who were really trying to get things done. So it was, you know, a very energizing place to work.
Yeah, it's from the descriptions in the book, it sounds like it was a place full of characters and full of energy. And it points out the difference between what you were describing now, with an industry full of money attracting lots of interest just because it has a lot of money, to what it was like then when there wasn't so much money and it was very much, it seems, about cultivating interest in HIV and AIDS.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, when I started, we had about $250 million a year for HIV in globally in the whole of the developing world. I mean, $250 million a year at a time when you already had over 20 million infections. You
that's know, amazing.
It was three times nothing, basically. And so people were trying to do the best that they could with the money they had, but acutely aware that we really did need more cash to even begin to address the problem on the scale that we already knew was extant. I guess one of the real problems was that, as in many other spheres of life, I suppose, what you do to get that money can compromise what you're then able to do with the money. Uh-huh. And I think that that's what happened to us in the field of HIV. To get the money, we had to essentially repackage, if not reinvent, the truth. Uh-huh. Because the truth was extremely unpalatable, particularly politically. You don't actually bring in a lot of cash in most countries by saying, hey, listen, HIV, because of the way the virus works, because of short periods of high infectiousness and long periods of very low infectiousness, actually is only spread by an extremely limited number of behaviors, which are concentrated in populations that we can very clearly identify. And those are the following. And those populations include, obviously, people who shoot up drugs, gay guys, men in prison, people who of all three genders who sell sex, and those that buy it very regularly. And they also include adults in societies that have a history both of polygamy and relatively high levels of female autonomy. Mm-hmm. And those societies are principally in Eastern Southern Africa. So to say, hey, look, HIV is essentially a disease of hookers, gay guys, junkies, mm-hmm. and Africans, was something that, for obvious reasons, was extremely difficult to vocalize. And so we sort of repackaged it as a everyone's at risk, this is everyone's problem. That did bring in the money, but it then makes it impossible to then spend that money on the groups that need it most.
Uh-huh. You introduced this really interesting term of beating up the data.
Oh, that's a term from my journalistic days. So in journalistic terms, to beat up a story is basically to make a really big deal out of a really small story, to make it much frothier and more important than it really is. And we did do that a bit with it. I will say, and I think it's really important to emphasize this, at least when I was working in UNAIDS, we didn't make up any data. Uh-huh. We were not falsifying numbers at all. Uh-huh. What we were doing was essentially photographing them in their worst light, if you want. Uh-huh. We were allowing people to make connections that weren't necessarily substantiated by the data. So you'd say, listen,
you were raising alarms, in other words, like in the background. I hear one right now.
Sorry, yes.
No. It's fine. It's a perfect example.
That's North London on a sunny afternoon.
Right.
Essentially, you're saying, here's what's going on. We've got a problem at the moment in men who have sex with other men, in men who buy sex from sex workers, in men who inject drugs, because most of the epidemic early on is concentrated among men. HIV comes with a penis mm-hmm. most of the time. But many of those men also have sex with women, and therefore, if they have sex with women and infect those women, then we will have HIV coursing through the general population. Mm-hmm. That was the unstated, or sometimes actually almost stated, corollary. So it's concentrated in these groups now, but if we don't prevent it in these groups, then it's going to threaten you, your children, mm-hmm. your maiden aunt. And of course, what's not true was that last leap of imagination, because unless, yes, a guy who gets infected in sex with a sex worker may well become infected himself. And yes, he may well pass on infection to his wife. But unless his wife has another sex partner within 2 months, she's actually really extraordinarily unlikely to pass on that infection herself. And most places where commercial sex is a main mode of transmission. So that would be many countries in Asia, Latin America, Eastern Europe. Most women are not having regular concurrent sexual partnerships. They may have sex with many different people in their lives, but they tend not to do it at the same time, which is what the virus essentially demands because of its very short periods of very high infectivity. So we were sort of saying once a woman's infected, she's going to go on and infect other guys. And basically, or we were implying that that was the case, and that wasn't actually true.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is then that you've essentially packaged this as something that threatens innocent women and children. And once you've packaged something as a threat to innocent women and children, the response that's demanded is a response that protects innocent women and children.
Mm-hmm.
And so we suddenly are doing all these programs for pregnant women and for schoolgirls and this and that. You think, no, that's not what we meant. What we meant was the best way to protect innocent women and children is to protect guys from getting infected in the first place in that very small handful of behaviors which exposes them.
Very interesting. So in the second chapter, you actually move from kind of this high level writing the reports and integrating and aggregating all of these data to the front lines, of HIV/AIDS surveillance in Indonesia. Can you talk about that transition?
Not an easy one. So I should say that while I was writing these reports in Geneva, I was also writing guidelines on how to do surveillance.
Uh-huh.
I worked with a very good team on trying to improve surveillance systems and whatever, and I was very actively involved in developing those guidelines. And it's very easy when you're sitting in Geneva or more frequently at some nice five-star resort a bit out of Geneva so that you don't get distracted.
Uh-huh.
It's very easy to make up these wonderful kind of indicators, questionnaires, and whatever. One of the problems of working for any international organization is that you have to try and homogenize things enough so that they can be used by any country. So by doing that, you essentially make them not relevant to any specific country or any specific situation.
Mm-hmm.
So you take this kind of general cookbook that says take protein, cook till done,
uh-huh.
And then you take it to the field and suddenly you're trying to make, oysters Rockefeller with a drizzle of balsamic something, something very specific. And you don't really have the tools. So I took these very general guidelines in which I was, quote, an expert to Indonesia, so fraudulent being sent there as if I knew anything, and tried to make them work in practice. And of course, for the practice, particularly the practice of sex, particularly the practice of the sale and commercial consumption of sex, is really very different when you're on a back alley along the railroad tracks in Western Jakarta than it is when you're in a five-star resort, on the shores of some lake outside of Geneva.
Right. So what was it like?
Well, it was really interesting because, of course, the only people who can put in your face how wrong you are,
mm-hmm.
are the people with whom you're doing the surveillance. So it's not by talking to other epidemiologists and other public health people that you learn what you should be doing. It's mm-hmm. by talking to, the hookers and the junkies and that you're working with. Now, remember, there was one classic example when I was talking to a transgender sex worker who's since become quite a good friend, Ines, and she was around at my house because I was trying to get her cast in some film. A friend of mine was a producer and was looking for a transgender to cast in a film, and I was like, oh, perfect, you can come to dinner and I'll introduce you and see. And we got quite late and we were in, what's politely called second bottle territory, except that it was a second bottle of really quite posh Scotch whiskey, which Ines was knocking back, because for all her, elegant stockings and high heels and beautiful eyelashes and perfect manicure, after all, she's still a bloke physically, so she can get through this stuff. She's knocking back. And I was like, God, honey, you have really expensive taste. You're going to bankrupt me with your whiskey consumption. I said, I don't know how you do that with, like, how do you support yourself with, like, 3 clients a week? And she looks at me as if, you know, I've just arrived from Planet Zog. She said, what do you mean 3 clients a week? And I said, well, we've just got the data in from our first survey, and, you know, and that's the average for transgender sex workers in Jakarta. She says, oh, that's because you're just talking to all the wrong people. Uh-huh. And I was like, no, Ennis, we're not. And in the way that you have, you know, when you're completely drunk and think you're a bit of an expert, you know, I start explaining to Ennis, you know, the randomized study design and how we're doing our sample frame and how we do it with probability proportionate to size and all this total nerdy stuff. Uh-huh. Here's what we do. We map. And she's like, oh, you're just talking to the wrong people. And I said, Ennis, you're not listening to me. We get a random sample of a question. She says, no, you're not listening to me. Any hooker who's on the streets talking to a researcher is a hooker who's not with a client.
Right.
You're talking to all the dogs. And I was like, oh my God, she's right. Of course. She's right. We're getting a completely biased sample.
Right.
We're getting a sample of people who are least likely to be with a client, because the people who are most likely to be with a client are not on the streets when, you know, when we're, or less likely to be on the streets when we're out there recruiting people. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, we have a downward bias in our estimate of the number of clients. And you're like, okay. And so it's from experiences like that that you think, okay, you know, that cookbook that I brought with me from Geneva, that recipe is not going to work, and we have to change it. So it was a really interesting experience that really, and a learning experience in a bigger sense in life. I mean, not, it sounds very pompous and portentous, but to actually remind yourself over and over and over again that research is not something that you can do to people. It's only something you can do with people.
Mm-hmm. And this is a theme actually that seems to run through the book, and that's, you know, taking a critical eye to all questions that you're asking about individual locations and trying to understand the place itself and how the questions emerge out of the place and are not so much imposed on it.
I think that's exactly right. And it puts us in a bit of a quandary because, you know, if you say basically everything's context specific, then there's no point in a way trying to do any research from which you can learn generalizable lessons.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in general, in epidemiological research, and this is not confined just to HIV, but to many fields, essentially, good epi research can tell you what works, but not how to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we know that increasing condom use in commercial sex will reduce new infections, but how to make that happen is very different in different contexts and different situations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if we allow ourselves to go, I believe fundamentally that you have to take local contexts into account, both when you're researching a situation and when you're planning a response. But if you allow yourself to go too far down that route, you get to the stage where you say, well, I don't have data for this city. I've got data for 21 cities across Indonesia, but not my city.
Mm-hmm.
So none of this is relevant to me. And it becomes an excuse not to do anything, the no data equals no problem sort of equation.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be a bit careful about the level of local specificity that you need and in a particular context.
Now, I love the story about Inez, and the book is filled with remarkable characters like her. And one of the things that comes through so strikingly is that even though epidemiology ends up representing individuals as numbers, this is very much about humans. And I think one of the most moving parts of the book was actually your description of how the first results about or from a survey on syphilis and HIV among transgender sex workers actually led you to cry.
Yeah, it sounds very pathetic, doesn't it?
But no, it sounds very human.
Well, we've done our calculations. You're right. You do everything in numbers. But one of the things you have to do when you're planning a survey, obviously, is to make a sample size calculation. And you make your sample size calculation based on your sort of worst estimate in a way of what the actual prevalence of the condition that you're looking at in the population may be. And we kicked around. The last data that we had was 3% HIV infection among transgender sex workers in Jakarta. And we kicked those numbers around. And I said, worst case scenario, that was several years ago, worst case scenario, just imagine 10%. And people are like, oh, they're ridiculous. I was like, yeah, well, let's just do that because, it's safe. It gives us a margin of error. And the lab had very kindly color-coded the sheets for me. And so they'd basically, so the positives were in green. The positives were in red and the negatives were in green, which gives you a real kind of at a glance. They just hand you a sheet of paper and you can see right away, how much red there is, and obviously you want it to be all green. And they handed me this sheet that just had like so much red on it, and I looked at it and I was just stunned. And I said to her, oh my god, and can I see the HIV sheet too? Because I thought I was looking at syphilis. I thought I was looking at something curable. And she says, that is the HIV sheet. And I was just devastated. You were like, oh my god, I've spent the last 3 months of my life, doing field work is hard work, and you spend a lot of time waiting around, and you spend a lot of time chit-chatting, and you spend a lot of time schmoozing, and you spend a lot of time having your toenails painted. A lot of transgender sex workers also have salons. I've had my hair cut like 17 times while you're sort of waiting around and this and that, and you chat to people, and you get to know their life stories and this and that, and then I'm just handed this sheet of paper that's a quarter red. And it's not a happy moment. The less happy moment was, so the reason that we planned this study in the first place actually was because a transgender sex worker, Lenny, who's a very she's a restaurant manager by trade, and she's very kind of organized and whatever, and she was kind of upset about what was going on in the community and knew that there were high rates of sexually transmitted infections and whatever, and she'd come to the, I was working with an NGO in collaboration with the Indonesian Ministry of Health, and she came to us for funding for what we call an IEC campaign, one of those awful HIV or public health acronyms, which is information, education, and communication. So basically she wants to hand out leaflets telling people how not to get HIV. And I said to her when she came in with this proposal, well, what do we know about behavior, and what do we know about levels of HIV? What do we know about levels of behavior? And she said, well, not much. Last survey was 6 years ago. So I said, well, why don't we find out that first, and then we'll be able to plan your IEC campaign better, right? So that's how we started collaborating on this survey. So when I got that piece of red paper and the syphilis, of course, it was the HIV was at a quarter and the syphilis was at nearly 2/3.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's a lot of benzodiazepine penicillin that you've got to plan for something. So I was absolutely gobsmacked, and having had a little bit of a weep in the ladies' room, I then got on my motorbike and went straight to Lenny's place and said, bad news, and showed her the results. And she was very quiet. Very quiet. And then she looked at me and said, well, we don't need an education campaign, do we? We need a care we need care services. And I was like, right on, girlfriend, that's you know, it's a we need a completely different response to the one that we were planning. Because when you plan things in the absence of data, you've no idea what you need, even when you're part of the community.
Mm-hmm. And so it seems like doing the groundwork, doing the investigative work of what's going on in the sex community helped to upend expectations about who was at risk and then how much HIV and AIDS was around. And it seemed like a similar kind of process happened in the community of drug users.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. It was the same. Oh, look, we're going to do education and, you know, we've got a pretty good idea that a lot of people are getting infected. And so you come with this public health nerd's attitude, which when you live and breathe public health, and particularly when you live and breathe a single disease, as most people in public health do, you know, I'm a TB person, I'm an HIV person, I'm a diarrheal diseases person, whatever it is, you know, we all have our little bubbles, and inside your bubble, what you are working on is the most important thing in the world. Mm-hmm. It always is. You're always the center of the universe. So, of course, HIV is the most important thing in the world. And everyone must really, and particularly everyone who's in some kind of high-risk category, must spend their whole time thinking about how to prevent HIV. And if they don't, well, it's because they don't know. So if we just tell people how to avoid HIV, then they'll think, oh, right, HIV is something I want to avoid, and therefore I'll change my behavior to avoid it. And that's kind of, you know, the health belief model essentially underpins most of public health programming, but it also completely ignores the realities of human life.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of us actually don't. I mean, I smoke cigarettes, for Christ's sake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do I think that smoking increases my risk of lung cancer? Absolutely, I do. Do I do it anyway because it's a lot of fun? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true of many things. And so our first assumption when we saw a lot of infection in drug users was, oh God, you know, they don't even know anything and they're sharing needles, and if we just give them the information, they'll stop doing it and this and that. And then when we did the first, again, I insisted on doing research before we planned programs. And what do we find? Knowledge is 100%. 100% of, I don't know what it was, I think the first sample size was 600 drug injectors, knew that sharing needles spread HIV.
Uh-huh.
And we've read the book, so I can't make you guess. But, you know, if you were to guess with 100% knowing that this spreads HIV, oh, and by the way, you also have 98% who would rather avoid HIV, and you have almost 70% who know where to get a clean needle and can afford it. Mm-hmm. So you think, oh, well, right. What percentage are sharing needles? 98%.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wait, how does that stack up? You know, everyone knows how to avoid it. Everyone knows that by sharing needles, they're exposing themselves to HIV. People don't want to get HIV. They know where to get clean needles. They're sharing needles anyway. So the data don't fit with our model, right? And, you know, obviously what's wrong is not what's wrong is not our model, because we're in public health. We know our model's right? So what must be wrong are the data. Well, no, what's wrong is our assumption that the most important thing in people's lives is the fear of HIV and avoiding HIV. And what happened when we did a little bit more qualitative work around that was that we found that, in fact, people do know where to get clean needles and they have easy access to clean needles, but they don't want to take a needle out of the house with them, because if they're found on the street by the cops, and the cops know who the junkies are,
mm-hmm.
But they can use a needle as proof of illegal behavior, and then they can arrest you. And most of the cops are not trying to put people in jail. Most of the cops are trying to get bribes. But obviously, to make the bribery process effective, is, if someone can't or won't give you a bribe, you put them in jail. So people are much more scared of getting arrested than they are of getting HIV.
Mm-hmm.
Because an arrest is a real inconvenience tomorrow, and HIV is a notional inconvenience 10 years from now.
So it's like there was this shift to having a better understanding of why people behave in a particular way. And then one of the other interesting parts of the book is, or has to do with, once you know that, you can design your interventions, but even being able to implement those interventions is often fraught with difficulty because of all sorts of other influences, like you were saying at the beginning, once you start to get the money, the people who give the money often have sway in how the money is spent. And it seemed like that was important both in the realm of commercial sex work with the availability and use of condoms, and also in the world of IV drug use with needle programs.
That's exactly right. I mean, the obviously, if you've identified the problem is not lack of needles. The problem is that people can't carry needles and can't use them and don't have access to them at the point where they're injecting drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So the solution is not actually in that particular case, the solution is not necessarily a needle exchange, because you're still going to have the problem of people not wanting to carry needles with them because of fear of arrest. So it changes what your intervention is into a political intervention, which is what we have to do is work with the police and the justice system so that people don't get arrested for carrying needles, right? It changes the whole nature of the response. And when the problem is a political one, the solution is generally going to be a political one. But we have this further problem that when the problem is a political one in a donor country, you can't find a political solution in the country of the implementing or where the program needs to be implemented.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't state that very clearly, but what I mean by it is this. The United States of America, for example, has been extraordinarily antipathetic, has been extraordinarily unkeen on funding needle and syringe programs, and mm-hmm. that's been true since the late 1980s. So at a time when countries like the UK already had universal access to clean needles through a publicly funded program that was instituted by that great liberal Prime Minister of ours, Margaret Thatcher,
uh-huh.
The United States was saying, we can't do that because giving people needles encourages drug use. And of course, what it encourages is people to share needles, and you had rates of over 40% infection in drug injectors in New York City, for example. But that antipathy that the United States has domestically to funding needle exchange programs, they then export through their HIV funding programs for other countries. And you can argue that that's a reasonable thing to do. You know, if the taxpayers of some country don't wish to support a particular intervention, then there's no reason that they should. But the problem is that they're actually creating really it's almost like diversionary tactics. So they're giving us money to do programs for drug injectors, but saying we can't do the one thing that we know is effective with drug injectors.
Mm-hmm.
In a country like Indonesia or in a country like China or in a country like, you know, so what we need to be able to do is lobby politically for support for needle and syringe programs in Indonesia and then provide those things. And we're not allowed to do either of those things with US money.
Right.
The Indonesian government isn't going to put any money into HIV prevention because we've got all this money from the US to do HIV prevention. So the Indonesian government's using its own money for other priorities. And frankly, it's no more politically popular there than it is in the States to say, oh, I'm just taking your tax money and spending it doing nice things for junkies. So we're in this bind, even if the country in question wants to use the money for a priority that they consider to be important. If the donor government doesn't wish to see the money used that way, it won't get used that way. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the distortions that's really introduced into the system by the whole kind of global aid and dependency model. And interestingly, the countries that have had by far the most effective responses to HIV also have the highest proportions of domestic funding for their programs. And I guess Thailand and Brazil would be two very good examples of that.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, Brazil actually turned down $40 million from the United States because it refused to, the Brazilian government refused to comply with one of the stipulations of one of the conditions of U.S. government funding for HIV programs, which is to say that to refuse to support the concept of commercial sex as a legitimate occupation.
It's fascinating. It's and infuriating. At the same time,
the other thing that infuriates me, which is a small thing but just drives me absolutely bonkers, is some of the structural conditions that we impose, such as in the States. I mean, I don't mean to harp on U.S. funding because many other donors have similar policies, but it happens that the U.S. taxpayer is extraordinarily generous, actually, in the field of international public health and particularly HIV programming. And you know, because there's so much U.S. money around, it sort of finds itself in the firing line quite a lot, ironically. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that all U.S. Overseas aid is subject to is the Buy American Act. And so you find yourself in this absurd position where you're in a country that's a huge producer of latex and one of the largest producers of condoms in the world, uh-huh. wanting to provide those condoms to hookers who are, you know, working within half a mile of the condom factory, and you have to buy your condoms from a manufacturer in Tennessee that makes them at approximately four times the price, uh-huh. and pay to ship them. I was like, I actually sat down on one, you know, long plane journey out of extreme boredom and figured out the carbon footprint of a condom that I was giving out to hookers in Jakarta. So if you take the latex, you ship it to Tennessee to make it into a condom and ship it back, you know, your condoms have carbon footprints of about 10,000 miles each.
It's amazing. And there are these revelations and observations throughout the book. And it's really one of the things that makes it such a pleasure to read is how eye-opening it is. And Elizabeth, I feel like we've taken up a lot of your time. So I'd like to ask a question about what's next. What are you working on now? What's your next project?
I've been working a lot on, because of the sort of ongoing frustration with the fact that we generate a lot more data than we actually use or use well. I've been working on an initiative that is trying to get many of the major funders of public health research in developing countries, also in the developed world, together to agree that any data that are generated by research projects that they fund will be put into the shared scientific domain so that everyone can look at one another's data, combine it, mash it together, do new analyses, bring new ideas and fresh eyes to it, so that hopefully for the same amount of data collection, we get more information and more new ideas. It's kind of the open source software concept brought to public health data. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, as you said earlier, you know, epidemiology, it's all about numbers and data. Yeah, it's all about numbers too. But every data set I've got data from 17,000 sex workers. That's 17,000 people who've allowed me to poke and prod them and who've pissed into cups and who've, you know, generously given me 40 minutes of their life that they will never live again to answer fairly intrusive questions about, you know, about insertive and receptive anal sex or whatever it is. And then for those data to be locked up on my computer, for only my benefit and those who happen to read the one or two papers that I actually get around to publishing, is nothing short of criminal, I think.
Well, that sounds like a hugely important project, and one that I'm eager to see put into practice. So thank you so much for doing the interview today. I had a great time speaking with you, and thank you again.
Was a great pleasure. Next time we'll do it in second bottle territory.
Excellent.
You've been listening to an interview with Elizabeth Pisani about her book, The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS, here on New Books in Medicine. I'm your host, Yonatan Grad. Have a great week.